Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject and the favorite subject of my guest today. Well, probably not the favorite subject. Complaining about taste and complaining about service and complaining about things you might think is his favorite subject, but actually he is someone who knows more and cares more passionately about restaurants and food and the experience of dining out than just about anybody I know. It's a pleasure to welcome to the studio the winningest James Beard Journalism Award winner, Alan Richman.
Listen, I'm not going to complain about the food. Already I complain enough about trying to find parking in Bushwick.
Well, old news.
If you can't park here, is there anywhere in New York you can park?
Well, you can park, but they might take your car, so be careful. Right? Illegal is probably better if at least the police get it and not some of the people here. So, Alan, there are so many things that we could talk about, and we're a few minutes late getting on air because we were talking about them already. I don't even know where to begin, but let me puff you up a little bit and say that you have written about restaurants for how many years now?
Over 25 years,
yeah. And you have seen a lot of changes in restaurants and in magazines and in writing and in all sorts of things, and right now you are writing weekly for the GQ.com, which is a whole new experience.
Absolutely. You know, I've been lucky in the sense that my life was relatively easy for a guy who's a professional eating. You know, as you know, eating is exhausting,
yes.
Even though it's
fun.
You
get no sympathy, but it's work.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But I used to have it really easy. I was doing it for a monthly magazine,
right.
And I wasn't even in every month. Now right. I'm weekly, and I have to go three times and maybe get ahead of it four times.
Really? Wow.
This is, you know, if you talk to Pete Wells or you talk to anybody, they say, it's a tiring job. And it is.
Right, it is. And it's one that really impacts the part of life that you wouldn't otherwise be relaxing in,
of
right?
Of course, no relaxation. Right. I have to, and of course, when I bring people to their meals, I have to yell at them. This is not a party.
But you do that when you're not working.
That's true, actually.
So I don't even know. There are so many topics. Why don't we start with the one that's on a lot of people's... Well, actually, today on everyone's mind is Michel Richard at Villard, I think, which is skewered in the New York Times this morning.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah. I was there a couple of months ago just to have a look at it. And it was... I remember it being relatively empty.
Right.
And almost... It was sort of so casual. It was like... They weren't quite... You know, you expect... energy in a restaurant.
Right.
The only thing I remember of this meal was the wine list was good, the food was pretty good, and there was no energy at all in the restaurant.
Right.
I have not read Pete's review yet. I heard about it. Everybody's
right.
heard about
right.
it, but I didn't read it yet. You know, I live in the suburbs. We don't get the papers for a couple of days. But I know that he was rough on it. But I remember that it was an odd restaurant, that there
yeah.
wasn't much going on when I was
there. Well, we'll wait for some others to weigh in. And I mean, I do know Michel Richard is a great chef. And
great
that's
chef.
That's the challenge. One of the great chefs that we've had
yes.
on our soil. And so, you know, and it's funny that everyone wants to come to New York at some point. I remember when Jean-Louis Paladin, another great chef from France, one of the greatest I feel like I've ever known, thought he just needed to open in New York City.
Yes.
At the top of the world, this guy, I mean, you know, best friends with Alain Ducasse, the whole world came to him.
Yes.
It's like, you just want to say, don't do it. Why would you do that?
I don't know. There is that need. By the way, I think Jean-Louis Paladin, I thought he was the best cook of French food that has ever been in this country.
I felt the same way. I didn't know we shared that opinion. Yeah,
unbelievable. Wonderful man. And I don't know, when you look at, you know, I think in a way it's getting easier to come to New York because, you know, the Pock-Pock,
right.
Ricker and Pock-Pock, they came here and opened casual places. That's a new thing.
Right.
Danny Bowen, who was here opening, you know, he had Mission Chinese. Right. Now he has Mission Cantina.
Like, welcomed with open arms. Can do no wrong.
Do no wrong. And the idea that you're coming in with casual places in New York, that's what's really the new thing right now.
Right.
And I don't know what's behind that. I was there at Mission Cantina, and Danny Bowen saw me, and he knew I was a great fan and of Mission Chinese, a huge fan. And he saw me, and I said, oh, you know, he did the usual thing everybody does in New York. Oh, I'm so exhausted. Why did I open in New York? It's so hard. It's so much work. I said, Danny, you look terrible in San Francisco. You look great now. What happened to you?
Right.
It doesn't seem so bad.
It's that urban, heroin chic, exhausted thing.
Yeah,
right?
It's over. He looks like right. I've never seen him. I wouldn't have recognized him. And he was so much more articulate in New York than he was in San Francisco.
We won't touch that. But I imagine, so for many of your 25 plus years at GQ, you were writing about restaurants nationally, crafting stories around them, traveling, and I would imagine you've never spent as much time in the New York restaurant scene, the drudgery of every week going out five times a week, like knowing it like the back of your hand.
That's right.
Yeah, so what are you finding out there? I mean, short of revealing any secrets that might be in an upcoming article, say.
Well, you know, we have the usual Brooklyn. It really does exist, and it's every bit as interesting as everybody says it is. We have the same problem.
Can I just ask, even if you come in from the suburbs, Brooklyn is still interesting?
Well, not getting to Brooklyn isn't interesting. Let me tell you that right now. I have been on the BQE more than any trucker in America today. I know every... I took the BQE.
You probably don't eat as well either as those truckers.
But I found that, you know, you do have to go to Brooklyn. So much is going on in Brooklyn. I found that Manhattan is becoming more frustrating to me because the restaurants in Manhattan more and more are about corporate, are about chains, are about people opening their second and third places, about way overpriced wine lists. I'm not happy with Manhattan. I'm really not. I know there are the we talked about Pete Wells, but he seems to find these little tiny places in the back of, you know, diners or grocery stores or whatever he finds them, and he falls in love with them, and that's a great thing. He finds them better than I ever can.
Right.
But when it comes to the more standard restaurants, you know, I'm not happy with Manhattan.
Do you think there's it's an economic
Absolutely.
Issue? The rents, it's just ridiculous. You can't do it on your own. You can't be creative or take a risk.
You can't. And, of course, everything's of a pattern where it's just, first of all, you know, noise is very important to these restaurants. That seems to be the one factor of Manhattan restaurants. Let's make them as loud as possible.
Right.
And after that, everything else just falls into place. But, you know, I'm having trouble getting excited about Manhattan.
Right.
And it's not that I love Brooklyn. I am not a Brooklyn phobe. I hate going to Brooklyn. I got to drive there.
Right.
But the restaurants are still more interesting over there. I don't know how you break this pattern in Manhattan. You know, do you give tax breaks to restaurants? But I want to see, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no. Well, so I just came back from Philadelphia where they, Monday and Tuesday, Drexel University started the first chef conference that has ever been held in Philadelphia for Philadelphia chefs. They sort of purposely didn't invite big names from New York, whatever. They just tried to cohere the community.
Right.
And one of the things, as I was eating around and talking to the chefs there that you kept hearing, because many of them, Pete Serpico from the Momofuku world, Eli, whose last name, I'll forget his last name, but at Fork, they've all moved from New York because they can live there, because they can be chefs. There is now a sort of critical mass of interest in food, and they can do things you maybe couldn't do in Philadelphia 10 years ago, but they can have a life and a house and a car, and they're as happy as clams.
Yes, I think you could have it also if you're in Bushwick or if you're in Greenpoint maybe is going to be the next one to have that. But you can't have it in Manhattan. It just doesn't exist.
So besides the restaurants, the food, what are you eating these days? Do you see, what's the trend? What's the next what is the next kale that everyone's looking for?
There may be another vegetable that soars into glory.
Sneaky vegetables that just creep up on you.
I mean, I think, you know, well, kale's had its day. Carrots have had their day, don't you think, for now? Romanesco is very big this year. Tell me something. Why is Romanesco capitalized? I don't understand that. Don't know. It is everywhere.
That's interesting.
I don't think it has a proper name.
Romaine lettuce capitalized?
I don't think so. Right. So the vegetable thing. But the trend right now is that interests me is that every chef is creating his own food. I was going to say or her, but no. I wanted to be politically correct, but I don't need to be politically correct because it's all guys.
Right.
And they're all...
Which is another conversation for another show. Yeah.
But they're creating their own experimental... This is what I think should be assembled on the plate and given to you in a tasting menu. Tasting menus are out of control, as you should know by now. And items that you've never seen before in your life are also out of control, or assemblages of items. That's the new trend.
And I hear some judgment in your tone about that. Let's pick that apart a little bit. What's part of the challenge of that giving up the control as the diner, or is it that you just think some things are it's just too random that you can't really grasp it?
No, I think chefs think they're geniuses.
Okay.
And I have – these people have come into my house.
Right.
I am feeding them. They are so lucky.
Right.
I am going to give them my creation. From my mind comes greatness. It's like an abstract painter.
Right.
And the people come. And they don't – it doesn't stop them. I've had some strange combinations. And I've been traveling around America, too, doing best new restaurants, getting prepared for this. We call it Perfect Night Out now for GQ. And this is everywhere. I mean, I went in one restaurant. I'll give you just the main three components of this dish. It's grits that are suffused with boudin, you know, the flavor of boudin. On top of that, or shoved into that, I should say, were pickled shrimp. And on top of that were pork rinds. And there was more. But this is what we're talking about.
At least all those things come from the same region, if not the same plate. I mean, I thought you were going to, I don't know, mention Pop Rocks whatever.
No. Local is big, too. So it's right. But everybody is creating dishes from their imagination. Right. And if you don't have some sort of classical training or background, it's often going to be really not very good.
Well, one of the challenges I've always thought about that is a challenge for the chefs as much as it is for the diners is our quote-unquote lack of an established food culture, which isn't about... only eating in a certain way, but comes with rules that everyone kind of understands, even if they're never expressed. And you do some things and you don't do other things. And within the context of that, people create and there's some order, even though there's creativity. Yeah. And here, I mean, as a chef, as a restaurant critic, you're supposed to know everything on earth. It's all available. You know, you could reach in and pull out Vietnamese sauce and Mexican whatever. And sometimes you have delicious things and sometimes you have a mess.
Yes.
That's a challenge for everyone in the system.
I don't know if it's a challenge for diners because they seem to accept it. It's certainly a challenge to understand it.
But if you never have the same thing twice in a restaurant, you can't learn, really.
Of course. Well, it used to be what a critic like me used to do. They would go to five restaurants. They'd all serve beef Wellington. You'd know what beef Wellington was, and you'd say which was the best version of it. There's no such thing as the best version of anything because there's no, as you said, nothing is repeated.
Right.
You know, the other way, of course, is the Italian who go out to restaurants to eat the same thing they cook at home.
Yes, right. And complain it's not as good as their mother's.
Right? But it is a problem because there's no standards. There's no established, this is the way it should be. It's tough on critics. You have to just, you know, it's not guess. You just think about it and you decide, is this good or is this not good? And it's hard to prove, you know, it's hard to prove it sometimes.
I mean, I have noticed personally... and I'm grateful for a little return to something I can't call anything other than deliciousness. Finally, we're away from, interesting, and coming back a little bit to, delicious, which is a shift, I think.
Of course, that was something that Chang used to talk about, David Chang, about delicious food. And that was his idea of what food should be. And he was good at it.
Right.
And, you know, and I don't know. You know, I would have agreed with you, but having traveled around the country, had a lot of non-deliciousness.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure everybody's thinking that way. I think it's geniusness now.
Careful, it's Dave. Wile E. Coyote, right, is out there and he's cooking. We are talking with Alan Richman about all sorts of interesting things about restaurants and foods and trends, and we will be right back after a short break. You're listening to Taste Matters.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I am talking with Alan Richman. It is always a pleasure to talk food and restaurants, and I would never dare to talk sports with him. But what you can't see at home is he's sitting here in a full veil, covered from head to toe, practically a burqa, so that no one can recognize him. And we are going to change the subject now to one that's in the food news anyway, and that is anonymity, as our other friend, good friend Adam Platt, appeared in full, I mean, a pretty great magazine move to put the food critic on the cover of the magazine and build up an issue. And when you go to read that issue, what you find out is there's no revelation. He's not leaving. He just decided everyone knows who he is anyway. It was a little bit of an anticlimax. What do you think about anonymity? You've always positioned yourself as the most normal guy in a restaurant.
Yes. And by the way, I want to say, even though they have his pictures, nobody's going to recognize Platt anyway, because he is so cranky when he's writing. He's such a sweetheart in real life. So, you know, you expect this really nasty man to walk in. Right. They're not going to spot him.
Right.
He's so nice and pleasant. Such a good guy.
Without a computer in his hands.
Yes.
Right.
No, I, of course, always believed and still do in anonymity. And now, so, you know, when I first started writing and nobody recognized me, my whole technique of writing was to be the poor schmo who walks into the restaurant, gets, you know, isn't dressed the way they want him dressed, even though I would always dress nicely.
Of course.
Worked for GQ.
Right, after
but I
all.
Didn't look like I was, you know, worth a fortune. And I'd always be treated terribly in restaurants. And that was wonderful for a story. So I love anonymity because I could be every man.
Right.
You know, and let me say right now, I wish I could do it that way. Forever, I think it's the best way to review restaurants. Now, having said that, it's impossible.
Right.
I've been around so long, it's really impossible for me. The only thing I do now, I still make reservations under fake names.
Right.
And I still don't ask them, because if anything, the one thing I can still do is not have them get ready for me.
Right. You can surprise them.
I can surprise them, and they don't have flown in the sous chef from Trois Gros to cook that night.
You're dating yourself.
Yes. Hey, I think it's still good. The wine list isn't, but I think the restaurant's still good. You know, so that's all I can do now. I mean, I'm recognized in just about every restaurant in New York.
And one of the things that I keep hearing, and this was a topic among the community in Philadelphia just yesterday, was that the blogger world has really impacted the publicity and the chefs, and they feel very a little on edge, uneasy about it, because everyone comes in and I write a blog, and they're the opposite of anonymous in some ways, but also they are as entitled as anyone could possibly be, and they don't know even what to do with them. They don't want to piss anyone off. You know, it's a really difficult negotiation, it seems.
Yes, and I've actually talked to publicists about this, what they are doing about this problem. Because not only do they walk into the restaurant and feel entitled, but they send emails to publicists, you know, trying to set up free meals.
Right.
You know, and it's a horrible situation. I mean, everybody who writes these these blogs. I mean, you know what I've always said about blogs, these bloggers, people say, what do you think of all these people who do their blog posts? Not blogs, I'm talking about those posts like on Yelp and on sort of thing, which is even more pervasive, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes more personally damning or something. I mean, so vituperative.
What my feeling is that I think it's wonderful that they do it because it takes psychos and gives them an outlet. But I think anybody who reads them for the purpose of getting information on restaurants is out of their mind too.
Right.
I mean, there's no sense of we know anything about journalism. You know, we talk about journalism again. This is journalism, and journalism really does have some rules of how to behave and how to conduct yourself and what questions to ask. And the people who do these blog posts, even most bloggers have no idea whatsoever what journalism is.
Right.
And reviewing is a form of journalism. So it is a craft. It really is.
Right. And you, I mean, aside from being what I would say a great writer and just a clever, funny, thoughtful guy, it's very clear in your writing that you think of the story, that you're not just there to recount what happened. I mean, obviously in a weekly column and the pressures, you probably have less time to craft the whole narrative, but I mean, when you sit to write, do you think of that story before, after, during? I mean, what's the approach for you as a journalist in this crazy world?
Well, if I'm going to a restaurant two or three times, I look for a eureka moment. You know, where I say,
mean when they're vacuuming. You actually mean when something happens. Right?
Something happens, and I say, I have a story. Because I try to write a story. Mm-hmm. You know, I want a beginning, I want a middle, I want an end. You know, just like the Western novel. Mm-hmm. I try to write one, you know, where the best stories are a tale of them that you start at the beginning and you finish it at the end. And if I can write that kind of story, that's good for the reader to read. But I also want this to be some sort of insight into the restaurant that I hope I have found and maybe others have not. And I want the eureka moment I'm talking about as an insight. What's happening at this restaurant? What's going on here? What can I say about it that will interest the reader and will tell the reader what it's all about? And that comes from years of journalism. Mm-hmm.
And when you set out to do that, as someone who is, you know, painfully honest, can turn an experience into a clever, I would say, complaint or jibe or whatever.
Mitchell loves to torment me, by the way.
Only because I love you and you're writing so much. And I'm being honest. I'm not even kidding here. I mean, I just, reading you is such a pleasure. And I miss that sometimes in food writing because, I mean, ultimately, we're all just having asparagus. I mean, we may be having asparagus with pickled shrimp and grits and what smoked ash spreads. But are chefs, do you find helpful? Are they resistant to you? Do they? I mean, some chefs have taken things you've said quite personally, I know, and that's difficult. But do you feel as the whole world is celebrating this food thing that you really need to remain an outsider, anonymous or otherwise, that you can't really play there because you need to have the space to say what you really think?
That is the trickiest game of all to play because I have to do both. Remember, everything I do isn't just a review.
Right.
If I just did a review, I could stay distant and maybe call a chef on the phone. But I also see these people. I write about these people. I write other stories about restaurants. Mm-hmm. I've tried really, really hard to know how to draw the line between going too far and I try to keep my distance, but also I want to approach them. Most chefs, by the way, I've been around so long, and I'm so old, that chefs are nice to me, to the most part.
Right.
I'm always surprised by that because when you're a writer and you're sort of isolated, you get the feeling that everybody hates you.
Right.
You know, it's that thing because the comments you read about your story.
I was going to say, and if you hear anything, it's from someone generally who hates you, not someone who loves you. That's just the nature of the...
Yeah, nature of... So you can have this idea that you really are not you're very much disliked. And I find that's not true.
Right.
And I'm always surprised to find that it's not true.
that might be a conversation for a different show. Doctor, whoever.
But I find chefs are so... I love chefs.
Right.
I truly love chefs. Yeah. They're so interesting. They work so hard. They suffer so much. They put up with people like me saying their food is no good. And yet when I approach them, 99% of the time they want to talk to me. They try to help me. They try to even inform me of what's going on. I mean, they're great people, chefs. They really are.
In the last few minutes, I know that you teach at the International Culinary Center, the one of the sponsors of this very show, in fact, and teach writing. And increasingly, I mean, just over the last 5 years, everyone I meet who wants advice wants to become a food writer or do something. And often they're bloggers, but often they're trying to bypass that route. What would you say to someone? We're so saturated with information about food right now. Is there a space? What should someone do?
Well, I mean, I go back to what we were talking about before. You have to know the basics of journalism. Mm. It's not that hard.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to learn. I mean, it's like I always look at ballet. I say ballet. Ballet doesn't look, it isn't that hard. It just takes 20 years to, you know.
To make it look simple. To make it simple, right?
Yeah, just a few steps, right? You can learn them in a week, right? All the steps.
Naomi Portman can, apparently, or whatever.
But food writing is the same way. I mean, if you have to start with a base of knowing what it is you're doing, and nobody does that anymore. They don't think it's necessary. We don't get that many young people who say, I want to learn to be a journalist before I want to learn to be a food writer. I don't know whether it's because they don't want to spend the money or they don't have the money, but they all think they can just start a blog and there they are.
Right.
And they know nothing about the craft of what they're doing. And I don't understand that. Don't you want to learn? Mm. And they don't.
Right. No.
They don't. Oh. I don't know what to make of that. They want to just go out there and start their own blog and become famous. It's like the chef who wants to go on television and become a star.
Right.
It's the same thing.
We heard that among the faculty in Philadelphia at Drexel yesterday, where they don't really know how to deal with the fact that a chef they find who opens their restaurant today is already thinking about his or her fifth restaurant and not what's happening today.
Yeah, well, yeah, I would say, remember when chefs stayed 15 or 20 years at a restaurant?
Yeah.
And work? It doesn't even happen.
Sorry.
That's all right. It just doesn't happen.
I always use as a marker, you used to write your cookbook at the end of your career when you had learned something, and now it's part of the beginning of your career. I've got a cookbook.
The publicity picture. You know, the same thing happens with new restaurants that opened up. Have you noticed this? That it used to be we would wait, you know, 6, 8, 10 weeks before you would review a restaurant. Now you don't do that. And one of the reasons is, everybody throws everything into the opening.
Yes.
I mean, everybody, they got their wine director there. They got the head chef
there for 4 weeks. Yes, the first four weeks, right?
Yes, the head chef, the great superstar chef will be there for 4 weeks because they know everybody's pouring in.
And everyone's tweeting from the family meal before it's even open. The pictures are already out there.
If you don't, I really believe this, if you don't have a high impact in your restaurant within 2 months, just close it up. Close it up because no one's going to, you'll never get another bit of publicity. You'll never get any more attention. The people who are coming there it's never going to get better.
And that's getting better is really what happens to restaurants.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
We've all been around long enough to see that.
Well,
no new restaurant is good. And if it is, something's wrong.
Right.
Don't you think? Like,
it should get better. I remember I got so much abuse for naming Lincoln. Best new restaurant of the year. And one of the reasons I named it, and it took people a while to understand it, was that this is a restaurant that's going to get better.
Right, it has.
And it has,
fact,
yes.
Yeah, no.
It's a beautiful restaurant in a fabulous space with a great chef, and he's learning to do Italian cuisine, which wasn't his specialty, and it's going to get better.
Right.
But no, and people said I was stupid. You know, you got to name the best restaurant, the one that is better now than it's ever going to be, and within a year it'll be closed.
Right. Right. Oh, that's a little bit sad.
Yes, it is a little bit sad.
It is. Well, and Lincoln is a perfect example. $20 million maybe, give or take. And how could you, I mean, if you were just going to capitalize that in 6 months or whatever the PR cycle is, you'd have to charge $1,000 an entree and, get in and get out. Huh.
Yeah, but you restaurants today, there's nothing about the long term of a restaurant that is promising. I don't think. And that makes me very sad. And I don't even write that much about older restaurants.
You were trying for a period to find some older ones that you could still write about.
You're right. I love that. I want to write about them. But I don't think the public's that interested.
Right. It's
and
true.
Then part of it, I just can't write about what I want to write about. I want to have to write about what people want to read about.
Which people sometimes forget in the food business that is the approach to the writing that you need to be a journalist, but also you also need to be responsible to your clientele, let's say, the reader.
Of course.
Not necessarily the eater. Yeah. Certainly not of a particular restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, one of my editors at GQ.com is Jessica Glavin, and she's fabulous. But I always hear in the back of her mind, you old fart, you don't know what a good restaurant is. I know what it is, you know, because I'm 26 years old. You know what I mean? I mean, she couldn't be sweeter or a better editor, but right. I just feel. So I say, okay, Jessica, where should I go? And she'll list five restaurants.
And she's going to get the story.
She knows.
That's funny. We even see that in our office at the Beard Foundation. There is a generational difference of appreciation for certain things.
Yes.
But I mean, it's what makes New York a dynamic, wonderful food town.
And it also the young generation is a food town for the young generation right now. It really is. And we go back to Pete Wells. And again, I didn't read the piece. Pete Wells not liking the Lard, which is an older generation restaurant.
That's so true. I remember when I first started dabbling in the food world 24 or 5 years ago, I always tell the story. We used to put on suits and ties to pretend we were adults. And now all the adults put on jeans and T-shirts to pretend they're the kids.
I know. That's another thing. Let's talk about. We can't talk about it now. Dress codes in restaurants.
Okay.
I mean, that's for another day. But my goodness. I mean, there has to be some standard. When I'm paying $400 for a meal, do I want to look at a bunch of guys in dirty T-shirts sitting at the bar? And this is in the winter. You must know how much worse it's going to get in the summer.
And we will leave our listeners imagining how much worse it might get in the summer, those dirty T-shirts. I would say it depends on the guys, but we won't go there. Thank you so much for taking half an hour to kibitz with us, Alan.
No. Half an hour to kibitz, a half an hour to find parking.
Okay, so a full hour of your day. We appreciate it to keep you from eating this young people's mishmash of food. You are listening to Taste Matters, of course. Next week, we're going to welcome probably someone who is drumming up those kids to rally around pork, Brady Lowe, whose Cochon 555 events around the country have become their own subculture of pigs, Pinot, and chefs. Until then, think about, why don't you go to a restaurant and actually think about what you're wearing and dress up for Alan's sake and enjoy yourselves.
Thank you, Mitchell. And by the way, perhaps lamb is the new pork.
Okay, we'll leave you with that. Doesn't do anything for my kale problem, but lamb is the new pork. Thanks for listening. This is Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.